Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Harrison Scott Key, author of The World's Largest Man, a memoir, and lawyer-turned-novelist Webb Hubbell, author of Ginger Snaps. And I'll have a word on Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. Harrison Scott Key teaches writing at the Savannah College of Art and Design and writes a monthly column, The Big Chief Tablet, for the Oxford American. He is, I believe, a comic genius, and he has written the funniest book I've read all summer, maybe all year, The World's Largest Man, a memoir. Harrison, welcome to The Reading Life.
That was so nice. I'm a comic genius. That is great. Thank you.
You definitely are. I laughed so hard reading this book that it made my dog very anxious to be around me.
I wanted to write a book that would make people's pets feel anxious, so I'm glad that you said that.
Well,
makes me feel better.
This is the standard by which I'll judge all books in the future.
My cat hated it. Thanks.
My dog hated my behavior while
yes,
I was reading.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, so tell us about your first trip to New Orleans for school.
I don't know. I guess that was maybe in sixth grade. And yes, I do write about that in the book. It was so fascinating because I tell people that the four largest cities in Mississippi are Dallas, Memphis, Atlanta, and New Orleans, because those are the ones that wherever you live in the state that you go to for your field trips and your concerts and to go to the big city. And for us, that was New Orleans. And I had read books about pirates and stuff, and I was always sort of fascinated by the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico and this whole, like, pirate culture. And I knew that New Orleans had some tenuous connections to various pirates. And so the city was always so fascinating to me just when I encountered it in books and in the random occasional movie that I watched when I was younger. And then when we came to the city, it was just so wild. I mean, the smells were the first thing I remember. And moving there in the 2000s, the smells were the first thing that reminded me of what it had been like the first time. You know, you can usually smell vomit and beer and coffee, and then there's some sort of pastry. Maybe it's beignets, but maybe it's something else. But all in the same inhalation, I had never experienced anything like that, short of being in a gas station bathroom near a great bakery, maybe. And it was so intoxicating in the weirdest way. And, of course, seeing all the Polaroids of half naked people on Bourbon Street, and then going to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. I don't think that's there anymore. But what was so funny is, like, you know, we went to Café du Monde, and we walked around the various streets, and we went to Bourbon Street. But just the smells and the sights, and of course, you know, being that close to rural Mississippi, which is a sort of backwoods, Bible Belt, conservative, I mean, it could have been the 1950s, it could have been the 1930s, it could have been the 1830s where I lived, as far as what it sort of looked like, what daily life was like, and the fact that driving to school, you might see a mule, you know, pulling a wagon or something. Or you might see three black guys riding horses with shotguns, just riding their horses down a gravel road. Just so insanely odd and sort of outmoded. And then coming to New Orleans, which was only, you know, like an hour and a half away, and seeing all these things and seeing boobies and seeing Café au lait and seeing beignets and seeing how people were acting and even how they spoke. You know, everybody sounded like they were from Long Island. It was just so strange.
I love it when you ask your teachers what those photographs of the strippers are, what they're doing, and the teachers go, gymnastics.
Yes, they're performing. They're very flexible, you know. And, of course, we didn't know. We knew that something was illicit about what we were seeing. But it was so strange. And it was in the light of day. I mean, it's not like we were there at midnight. And I remember when we went to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, nothing seemed crazy in that museum because it was in New Orleans. Like, that is the worst place to put that museum because they're showing you like a real shrunken head from some tribe in the Amazon. And then I'm like, I think I saw a guy with a shrunken head walking into this museum. Like, there's nothing weird about this.
And you came back again for your honeymoon, like Scarlett and Rhett, as you point out. Right. And then you taught at Tulane for a while?
Yeah, I sort of had two jobs at Tulane. I wrote grants and did a lot of development writing for the Health Sciences Center. And then I taught a playwriting workshop in the English department. So one was downtown, and then I taught uptown. And that was in, I guess, 2004. And we moved away from New Orleans about a month before Katrina. And our house, we lived in Lakeview, and our house was destroyed. And we shared a duplex with my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, and they still live there. And so we moved and they stayed, and, you know, as soon as they let people back in the city, we went back to help them clean out everything. And it was so strange to see our old house that we had literally just moved out of, completely empty, and see what it looked like, you know, destroyed, of course, as I'm sure your listeners and you're well aware of what homes look like after the storm. But, yeah, it was a close one, moving out that soon before the storm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your father, the world's largest man. And in this book, he does seem large in every way. I love the way you said he had a head that was like a Death Star. And you and he did not have the easiest relationship at all.
That's one way of putting it, yeah. You know, in some ways, I think everybody has some sort of great mystery in their childhood that they're trying to solve. And for some people, it's, you know, why do I live here? Or why do I not look like my mom? You know, maybe it has something to do with their friends or where they go to school. But for me, there were a lot of questions I had when I was a child, but it was really like, how can this man be my father? And it wasn't a sad question. I wasn't tortured and always wrangling with it as a child. It was just sort of fascinating. And I think the more books I read and the more I encountered other minds and became curious about the world, the more that question seemed curious and interesting to me of, like, here's a guy that, you know, I didn't really look like him. I looked like my mom, although there are many moments as I get older where I look in the mirror and I'm like, that is my dad right there. That is, you know, everybody has that experience where you make a face or you have an expression or you get the right angle. But as a child, I felt like I looked more like my mom. I was told I looked like her. I wasn't built like him. And I don't know, I just felt so different from him. And the things that he was interested in, I had absolutely no interest in. And I felt guilty for that. I felt like he spent so much time and money and energy to coach my football teams and baseball teams, to take me hunting, to take me fishing. I mean, I have three children now, and we're just now getting into sports and activities and things like that. And it's very expensive. And I knew that as a kid, and I heard my parents arguing about money, and I knew that money was an issue, and I knew I could see him spending all this money on things that I just did not like. And I tried so hard to love what he loved. And that was the big mystery for me. It's like, how am I related to this guy? Like, I think even as a boy, I remember thinking, how sad must he be that I'm so different from him? And you can't really have that conversation with your dad, right? I mean, men and women across the generations have attempted to have that conversation, but there's some impenetrable barrier there between, you know, at least one parent and every child that they can't cross, whether because the parent is dead or the parent is gone or the parent just doesn't speak that same language. And in some ways, I started telling these stories about my dad as a way to explain him to girls that I was bringing to the house, that, like, you know, some girl that I was dating. And I'm like, all right, so let me tell you about my dad. And I thought if I could tell a funny story about him, like, he might say something inappropriate about your thighs, you know, he might start talking about breasts, and he's not really, you know, lewd, he's just going to seem lewd. You know, we have scientists working on the problem of what's wrong with my father. We don't know yet. But I thought if I could say that, then when they would meet him, that would somehow distinguish me from him. Like, I'm aware that he is a complete weirdo or a nut or whatever. And the older I got, the more stories I told. And I just found, you know, whenever I was sitting on somebody's front porch or sitting around a bar and everybody started telling stories. The ones about growing up in the South or the ones about growing up out in the country or having my dad as a dad were always the ones that got the most laughs, that were the funniest. And clearly I was tapping into some great question that I had about who he was and that he was such a larger-than-life personality. And I really turned out in some ways to be also sort of a larger-than-life personality. I mean, I've done comedy improv, and I tried stand-up for a little while. I write funny stories, and, you know, I play the drums, and, you know, I tried my hand at acting. I was terrible at it, but I had no problem getting up on stage and screaming at people for 2 hours. That was fun. And so clearly I have a lot in common with the man, but the book was really my way of saying, how can this guy be my father? How could I have ended up like I ended up? I mean, that's a problem that so many parents have with their children. And in fact, I guess you could argue that that's a challenge that every parent has, is you don't want to remake your children in your own image, but you sort of kind of do, right? I mean, You love books. I love books. So what do I do with my kids? I take them to the library, and I take them to the bookstore. I literally drag them there, and I try to get them excited about it. And I know that at some point, one of my three daughters is going to be like, I hate reading. Why is this man taking me to these places? I buy my children so many books, and now that I'm writing for HarperCollins, occasionally I get my hands on a handful of ARCs or galley copies of upcoming young adult or youth books, and I give boxes of them to my children, and I'm sure they think, like, this man is crazy. Why is he trying to turn us into, like, savants of reading? And exactly the way I was about my dad. And, it, you know, the cycle just keeps going.
But you come around to love the way everybody does in the best kind of memoir. You know, you really do connect with him in your heart.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think realizing that the man, that his racism and his misogyny and his sort of obtuseness and his ignorance and all those other things that in some ways we attribute to our parents, the backwardsness that we all like to, you know, at some point all of us think our parents are backwards and think they're morons. I mean, that's a universal experience, I think. But for me, realizing that all those terrible qualities were really just surface qualities, that inside the man, I wouldn't call him, you know, a hooker with a heart of gold, but inside the man, there was a great deal of love, and it took me a long time to see what that love looked like and how it came out. And in some ways, the book is me saying, like, hey, not just talking to my dad, but really talking to my whole family. Like, you guys are effing weirdos. Like, something is wrong with all of you, but I love you, and I realize that I'm a weirdo, too. And anything that's bad in me is your fault, and anything that's good in me is your fault, too.
I think you're the best kind of weirdo.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Harrison Scott Key, whose terrific new book is The World's Largest Man, a Memoir. You can meet him Friday, July 24th at 6 at Octavia Books, and there will be prizes for the best question.
Oh, definitely.
Yes. Thank you so much, Harrison.
This has been fantastic. I hope your dog recovers from those episodes when you were laughing insanely. But I appreciate you reading the book, and I've had a great time talking to you.
Hubble's resume is impressive enough. U.S. Associate Attorney General, Chief Justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court, Mayor of Little Rock, Arkansas, Managing Partner of the Rose Law Firm, the second largest in Arkansas. Now he's working on a new line in that resume, author. His first legal thriller, When Men Betray, introduced Jack Patterson, legal who goes home to Little Rock to come to the rescue of an old friend. Now he's back with Ginger Snaps, another Little Rock set thriller. Webb Hubble, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Now, you could be taking it easy, but no. So what was the challenge that led to writing fiction for you?
Well, I think everybody's got a novel in them, or at least one, and hopefully in my case more than one. And I'd always wanted to write fiction. And about 5 years ago, I had a liver transplant. And my wife and I decided to pack up and move south to get closer to my children. And when I got here, I had to do something, so I decided to write that novel that all of us think we have in us.
Well, lots of times someone has a bad novel in them, but you had two good ones. So I have to ask you, how much of yourself were you able to put into this character? If you're going to spend time with him, he's going to be an alter ego of sorts.
Well, they do start speaking to you. In fact, all the characters started speaking to me about halfway through it. But a lot of people see a lot of me in Jack Patterson, but I don't see it as much as others do. Every character is kind of a compilation of personalities that I've met over time.
So you've made it clear that this is your fictionalized version of Little Rock, and you don't live there anymore. So what's it like to go back there when one of these books is published?
Well, that was kind of fun because everybody thought they were Jack Patterson. And nobody wanted to own up to being the governor or being the hotel manager, Brenda.
I can see that. Now, but you think Little Rock was the center of the criminal universe after reading one of your books.
Well, you know, I think every city has a dark place. Certainly when I was mayor, I learned a lot about the dark side of Little Rock. But I don't think it's any worse than anywhere else. But things happen in major cities, and certainly they've happened in Little Rock before. So I drew on experience. I didn't draw on really total fiction.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really important about a series is that the reader has to want to follow this hero onward. Now, you've given Jack Patterson a really interesting set of problems and attributes. He's a widower after a very happy interracial marriage. He has a daughter. He has lots of resources at his disposal. He wants to do good. He wants to protect his friends. So how far down the road are you looking as you write his life book by book?
Well, you know, when I first started writing, I really wanted to tell a story about the South and what it was like to grow up in a very changing time when African Americans were starting to go to high school, starting to go to colleges with white students and what that was like. And then the characters started developing themselves. And then when I was about halfway through, I said, you know, we could do several of these. And so that's how Jack Patterson continues to live on. And the third one, which I'm writing right now, is actually set in Washington, D.C.
Oh, good. I wondered if you were going to have him parachute into Little Rock in every book.
No, I think twice is enough.
Yeah.
He needs to move around a little bit now.
So do you have plans for all the characters who return as they go forward in this series? Have you thought beyond three?
You know, what happens is that about halfway through the book, the characters start to talk to you. They did in the first one. They did in Ginger Snaps, and I'm about halfway through, and they're beginning to get angry with me the way I'm writing them in book three, so I'm going to have to make some adjustments.
Oh, well, better listen.
Yeah, I do. I do listen to them, believe me.
So what are your favorite parts of these novels to write? I mean, you have action sequences, you have legal maneuvers, you have parts of soul-searching, you know, by individual characters. So what are the fun parts for you?
Well, every bit of it is fun. I got to tell you, I've done a lot of things in my life, as you read at first, but I'm having more fun now writing novels than I've ever had. So every bit of it is fun, but I enjoy every now and then inserting, you know, something that kind of my personal view of the world, whether it's the criminal justice system or politics or the influence of money on politics. I enjoy kind of inserting a dig in every now and then.
Well, you're only human, you know. You have to enjoy that. So tell us about Ginger Snaps. Tell us about the title, which is so entertaining. And you have certainly chosen a subject that will appeal to a lot of people, as complicated as it is.
Well, Ginger Snaps is kind of the follow-up to When Men Betray. And once again, Jack is back leading his life in Washington, D.C., and he gets another call. And this time it's his wife's best friend, who worked with her at NIH before she died. And he's been busted for growing marijuana in his backyard in Arkansas. And so Jack, more than to help his friend, just is going to go down there and find out why was this world-renowned chemist growing a garden full of marijuana in his backyard, and why does he claim that Jack Patterson's his lawyer? He didn't remember any promise to represent Doug Stewart, who is the chemist.
And also, what's the special ingredient in his wife's ginger snaps?
Well, he doesn't find that out for a while.
That does call into question a lot of what the characters say.
That's true.
Oh, so who do you read for inspiration, or do you read for inspiration as you write?
Yeah, I read all the time. I think any good writer needs to read twice as much as they write. Obviously, when growing up in the South, you were influenced by Harper Lee and Robert Penn Warren and Faulkner. And then recently, Conroy is one of my favorite authors.
Oh, yeah.
And I love Grisham's. I've read just about every book he's written. So I read a lot, but I don't try to mimic any of them, but I try to draw on what you learn from all great writers.
Well, they're so much fun to read. The characters are just so appealing and interesting. And the legal stuff to me is fascinating. Some of the stuff in Ginger Snaps just kind of made me sit up and go, whoa, okay.
Well, I'm glad you had that reaction. That was what I was hoping to get.
Oh, well, I think a lot of people will have it. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Webb Hubble, whose very entertaining new book is Ginger Snaps, a Jack Patterson thriller. You can meet him Friday, July 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Webb.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be talking with you.
How many times have we closed a book and later thought, I wonder what happened to those characters? What happened to Dorothy Gale back in Kansas? Did Jane Eyre and Rochester ever have children? Is Nancy Drew driving a black SUV now? In Harper Lee's eagerly anticipated Ghost at a Watchman, we get to see what happened to one of the most beloved of all fictional characters, Scout Finch, and her equally admired father, Atticus, in later life. Oddly, we are experiencing these versions of these characters in reverse order of their creation, so preconceived notions and long-held affections may hamper our perceptions of them in this messy first draft with its questionable history. In Ghost at a Watchman, Scott comes home to Macomb, Alabama from New York. She's 26 now, worldly in her own eyes. She's uneasily fond of hometown boy Henry Clinton, worried about Atticus, who has rheumatoid arthritis and needs care, and bereft of her brother Jem, who died at 22, perhaps the cruelest blow of all. Scout chafes at the bonds of the familiar, insisting on wearing slacks, being bored stiff at a welcoming coffee, amused at the gossip that results after she and Henry take a late-night swim in the river. And she remembers her girlhood, her first period, a pregnancy scare due to the lack of basic birds and bees info, and falsies that seem to have a life of their own outside her dress. Further on down the road, she can only envision future discomfort if she comes home to Macomb as Henry's wife. But on this visit home, nothing shocks and hurts and disappoints her more than witnessing the town elders, her father and Henry included, at a citizens' council meeting in the courthouse, no less. They listen politely to a racist speaker, and later Scout finds a racist leaflet, The Black Plague, with her father's books. Heartsick and angry, she's propelled into one conversation after another, in which everyone tries to set her straight about the nature of race relations and political realities in Macomb, Alabama. These are some of the novel's weakest passages, lengthy and pompous and infuriating. How is Scout to think of Atticus now? It is interesting that in this version, she recalls Atticus defending a black man from a rape charge and getting an acquittal, rather than remembering Tom Robinson's conviction. If Atticus Finch is not the Southern man we admired all those years ago, he is certainly an incarnation we can recognize. Home is never the sweet and simple place we think it is it? This early draft shows up by contrast what an improved work resulted after Harper Lee did a major revision at the behest of her editor, Tay Hohoff. We all have our cherished memories of Scout and Jem and Dill, at large in a small-town summer, with freedoms children these days hardly understand. Now Scout is older. That freedom is not so expansive as she thought, and she sits outside the family homestead, an ice cream parlor now. As that childhood treat melts all over the table, she confronts the limits of her own heart and the sad realization that her father is flawed after all. The mystery in this literary curiosity piece is the leap forward that came after, the elegance of the portrayal of young Scout, the change to a more realistic verdict in the Robinson trial, the idealized yet still complex portrait of Atticus, the unforgettable appearance of Boo Radley. All that made To Kill a Mockingbird a Pulitzer Prize winner. That's one secret Harper Lee will always keep, that transition, that evolution. But there is one consolation. It is summer, and we are reading Harper Lee's sharp-eyed look at a small-town life and Southern history, just as readers were 55 years ago. There is a kind of pleasure in that return, in having that curiosity satisfied after all this time, but also a cautionary note. Be careful what you wish for. You might not like it. And in this case, you certainly won't love it. Sweeter to remember Atticus and Scout and Makem as we first met them. But Go Set a Watchman casts a long and complicating shadow over that first love. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. David Spielman signs The Katrina Decade, Images of an Altered City, Tuesday, July 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Elizabeth Dowling signs Classical Interiors, Historical and Contemporary, Tuesday, July 21st at 6 at Gallier House, 1126 Royal Street. The lecture is free, but email info@classicist-nola.org to reserve a spot. The Pirate Sally Faulkner Society is partnering with One Book, One New Orleans to kick off 100 days of One Book, One New Orleans Wednesday, July 22nd at 5:30 at the Cabildo. The book selection this year is New Orleans Boom and Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot by Brian Boyles. Boyles will give a reading followed by a discussion with Nancy Dixon, author of N.O. Lit. Michael Ross discusses and signs The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case, Race, Law, and Justice in the Reconstruction Era, Wednesday, July 22nd at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. Laura McNeil signs Center of Gravity, Wednesday, July 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Vita Stamp signs Flexible Wings, Thursday, July 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Saturday, July 25th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Ed and Susan Poole, authors of Hollywood on the Bayou, discuss the film history of Louisiana Thursday, July 23rd at 10 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Harrison Scott Key, signs The World's Largest Man, a memoir, Friday, July 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Webb Hubble, signs Ginger Snaps, Friday, July 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Gary Wiviot and Colleen Rush sign Low and Slow Two, The Art of Barbecuing, Smoke Roasting, and Basic Curing, Sunday, July 26th at 2 at Octavia Books. Poet-songwriter Jonathan Warren reads from and signs Go to the River, followed by an open mic, Sunday, July 26th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Sue Kiros, president of the Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Van Club, will host a panel of women writers who write about the paranormal, fantasy, sci-fi, and horror realms. That's Tuesday, July 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The authors are Alice Arden, author of The Casket Girls, Deborah Burst, Hallowed Halls of Greater New Orleans, Dawn Chartier, Bewitching the Enemy, and Alexandra Weiss, The Art of Sin. And Find Waldo Local in New Orleans, the hunt for the popular children's book character Waldo, ends with a special Waldo party Friday, July 31st at 5:30 at Octavia Books. And a very big shout out to Tom Piazza, who's the recipient of the Louisiana Writer Award this year for his many contributions to Louisiana Letters. He'll be receiving that award October 31st at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife at www.nosweeklylook.org. WNO.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.